Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
The Telegraph. Podcasts.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you updates from across the continent as NATO meets in Bucharest. We discuss the visit of the President of Kazakhstan to Moscow and speak to Alona Shevchenko, lead at Ukraine DAO and Kyiv Tech Summit, about crypto, fundraising, and her trips back to Ukraine.
This hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure.
Putin's war in Ukraine has destabilized energy markets the world over.
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground, to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, the 30th of November, day 280. And today, I'm joined by foreign correspondent James Kilner and our guest, Alona Shevchenko. Just a few updates are needed before we talk to James. A huge fire has ripped through an oil depot in Russia's Bryansk region near the border with Ukraine on Wednesday, following a suspected drone attack. The Russian governor did not say what caused the fire, but the pro-Kremlin Izvestia newspaper reported it was caused by an unidentified munition dropped from a drone. The suspected attack comes after two fires raged at fuel facilities in the city in April, and there was immediate speculation that they'd been caused by Ukrainian missile strikes or sabotage teams. Germany will provide Ukraine with more than 350 generators after Russian missile strikes severely damaged Ukrainian infrastructure. The European Commission has proposed confiscating Russian assets that have been frozen to punish Moscow for the invasion. And in Spain, a worker was injured after a letter bomb sent to the Ukrainian embassy in Madrid exploded in his hands. The letter was reportedly addressed to Ukraine's ambassador in Spain and contained a small homemade explosive. The EFE news agency said the device had not been through a security scanner when it was opened. I invited James Kilner to talk us through some of the stories he's been looking at this week.
Hi, David. I think it's really important people looking at the news about Ukraine and the war today and this week keep a very close eye on what's going on in Bucharest at the NATO summit. This is the big annual jamboree, the big get-together. And there's a lot of issues going on. Obviously, the NATO partners, etc., are continuing to discuss the war in Ukraine, and especially the winter war that Russia and the Kremlin is waging on Ukraine. And today, the NATO General Secretary was warning of an increase in people fleeing from Ukraine into Europe to escape temperatures which are dropping to minus 10, etc., already. At the end of November. And then one really complicated and very interesting NATO question that's been bubbling over since May is Sweden and Finland trying to join. They approved that they were going to join in mid-May, and they thought it'd be pretty much an easy thing to achieve. The problem has been Turkey. So to join NATO, you have to have every single other member agree to this. Turkey's a NATO member, and Erdogan's been playing a very hard game with Finland and Sweden trying to join. He basically wants both those countries to make more concessions to his way of thinking and looking at how the world works, etc. And he's pushing them very hard on the issues of their support or their previous support for the PKK, the Kurdish national group in Turkey and Syria, which Turkey sees as a terrorist organization. So there's a huge bone of contention between Turkey and Sweden, Finland on that issue. And that's definitely something to watch out for. Importantly, also, NATO has reaffirmed that it still wants Ukraine to join the Western Defense Alliance. I mean, that's more of a symbolic show of support for Kyiv and Ukraine rather than anything practical at this stage. I mean, it first said that it wanted Ukraine and Georgia to join in 2008, and it hasn't achieved, you know, neither Ukraine or Georgia has achieved this. And as things are at the moment, that is not going to shift. But the actual act of reminding Russia that it can't have a veto on who joins NATO, reminding Ukraine that essentially Europe and the US, et cetera, want Ukraine in their club is quite important. Aside from that, I was on the desk over the weekend, and we had an interesting story about a group called the Council of Mothers and Wives of Servicemen. This is a Russia grassroots organization, which is fairly rare in itself. And they have been anti-war from the start, and they've become increasingly vocal since mobilization was called by the Kremlin in mid-September. And they got very upset on Friday when Putin met a hand-picked group of so-called mothers for tea at a residence, one of Putin's residents in the outskirts of Moscow, in a very carefully stage-managed photo op, video op. This in itself was interesting for the Kremlin, because it was admitting for the first time by Putin that he upset and irritated a lot of people and angered a lot of people with his mobilization call. So that in itself was an interesting insight into Kremlin thinking. But once again, the Kremlin's knee-jerk reaction is to try and absolutely control the message. And he handpicked this group of women to have tea with for a couple of hours. And they were all staunchly pro-Kremlin, pro-war women who got track records of supporting the Kremlin and being sort of on the Russian nationalist side of things. And this really upset the real grassroots groups of mothers and wives of servicemen in Russia, who have been terribly upset by the mobilization process, which has sent a lot of their men down to war and on the front lines of Ukraine with only a few days of training and inadequate weapon and body armor, etc. And they, on Friday afternoon, called on Vladimir Putin to go and meet them in Red Square on the Sunday, you know, a few days ago, and to talk with them properly, face-to-face. Of course, this was never going to happen, but there was maybe an expectation that the mothers would turn up anyway and try and protest against the war in Russia, as we know, are illegal. But the night before and Saturday night and Sunday morning, they're social media page on the main Russian social media channel VK had been blocked by the Prosecutor General of Russia. If you went onto the page, then it would say this page has been blocked in Russia by the Prosecutor General under the orders of the Prosecutor General. So the authorities were, you know, they're cracking down on this. They're expecting something. They cracked down, and lo and behold, the protest or the meeting never happened. It shows the Kremlin way of thinking. They cracked down. And it shows their control of the scenario and how they can manipulate the Russian population, etc. Moving very quickly on, we had the Kazakh president, Tokayev, was in the Kremlin, travelled up to Moscow and went to see Putin on Monday. This was his first overseas visit since being re-elected as president last week. He was under a new constitution. He won a 7-year term, which must be one of the longest in the world. It's quite remarkable. But the importance of him going to see Putin was that, as he said, it was a symbolic gesture of the strength of the relationship between Kazakhstan and Russia. Now, Central Asia and Kazakhstan have had to play a very difficult game throughout this war to make sure they keep on side with the West and their sanctions and economic demands, but not alienate themselves too much from Russia, which is one of their key benefactors, et cetera, et cetera. And it had felt that the Central Asian states had shifted quite dramatically away from Russia's orbit. But this visit in itself reminds people that Kazakhstan and others have a limited room to manoeuvre. So that in itself is very interesting. And then finally, I just wanted to flag up a Reuters report, which came out last Friday, which was very interesting. It was about secret talks held in the UAE and mediated by the UAE, which was also important, between Ukrainian and Russian officials about reopening an ammonia pipeline between the city of Togliatti in Russia and Odessa on the Ukrainian ports. This in itself is interesting for two reasons. It comes at a time when the US is trying to pressure Ukraine into sitting down with Russia and having proper peace talks. Ukraine said it's not prepared to do that until Russia retreats from all the territory it has occupied since 2014. But so any sign of peace talks, secret peace talks between the two sides, even over something as seemingly innocuous as an ammonia pipeline, is really important because it means there is dialogue going on, etc. And all this is building blocks of potentially something bigger. The second reason is that although we've had a very high profile deal to allow grain shipments out of Ukraine, analysts and negotiators have always said that there's, as well as being a grain shortage around the world, there's also been a fertilizer shortage, which is obviously really important to increase productivity, et cetera. Ammonia is the key chemical product, one of the key chemical products in fertilizer, and Russia is a major exporter of it. So reopening this pipeline, it's not clear if it has been reopened yet, is potentially really important for global food sources, et cetera. So I think those are the key issues for now, and I'll let you get on with the rest of the podcast. Sounds like a great one.
Thank you very much for that, James. It's a great privilege to welcome our guest today, Alona Shevchenko. Alona, thank you so much for coming into the office to talk to us. Just to start off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your life, and what you were doing and working on before the full-scale invasion in February?
Hello, David. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me here, first of all. So before the full-scale invasion began, I was working on various Web3 projects, and that kind of led to what later became Ukraine DAO that I started with two of my friends 3 days before the full-scale invasion on the 24th of February. And essentially, it's a combination of blockchain fundraising, and it's also turned into like a multimedia platform that amplifies Ukrainian voices. And we also do quite a lot of work fighting Russian propaganda.
Can we get into some of those terms? Because I appreciate there'll be quite a few listeners for whom some of this is very, very new. So we've talked about blockchain, Web3, DAO. Can you just go into that? Feel free in detail, really. What should the listener who doesn't really know much about the world of crypto and blockchain, what should they know about what you're working on? How does it work? And I guess one big question is, why is it more effective or quicker than more traditional routes of fundraising?
So crypto stands for basically cryptography, and it's a way of storing and recording information in a transparent way, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be linked to any financial speculations and so on. It's a very diverse technology. It's neutral, and it can be used in multiple different industries like logistics, medicine, and so on. And then DAO, so the project that I co-founded with my friends is called Ukraine DAO, and the DAO stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. It kind of has its origin in more technical communities that started organizing a few years ago. But right now, it's pretty much with social impact DAOs, for example, it's a community with a certain mission. And so Ukraine DAO's mission, for example, right now, is to help Ukraine win. So we do whatever is in our power to assist in Ukraine's defense.
Can you take us back to February, to March, and tell us a little bit about your life and how it changed after the full-scale invasion? And tell us about the founding of Ukraine DAO. How did that come about? What did you do?
It pretty much came out of me going to protests and getting really worried in the weeks preceding the 24th of February. And my friends who knew that I was very passionate about Web3 and very passionate about Ukraine as well, they suggested to me, why don't you start a DAO? And that was because DAOs became last year kind of like a buzzword, right, that generates a lot of publicity. And publicity is what you want if you are Ukrainian, because it's very hard actually to keep Ukraine in the news cycle, right? It's been 9 months now, and sometimes we really struggle to keep the focus on Ukraine. And so DAO, you know, it sounded like a good option, and it was also because Ukraine is a very crypto-friendly country. So Ukrainian charities, we decided to start from fundraising and helping Ukrainian charities that already were accepting crypto for years. Ukrainian charities were they already had the infrastructure for it, right? So it was much, much easier to do that than in other countries. And so we started from that. We started raising like a couple of days after the full-scale invasion began, and within a few days, we raised over $7 million worth of crypto. We transferred the vast majority of it to Come Back Alive, which is the leading charity in Ukraine that supports the army. And that was because supporting the army in Ukraine is the highest priority for everyone. Then we also sent about $1 million worth of crypto to the Ukrainian official wallet, the government's one. And then some funds also went to a charity supporting LGBT community and towards mental health support.
$8 million is a huge amount of money, so congratulations on that. May I ask, did you expect that? Did you expect to be able to reach so many people or reach people with such deep pockets? And if I can ask, where does this money come from? Do you have a sense of who's donating?
First of all, no, I didn't expect. I didn't expect anything from Ukraine DAO. And to be honest, up until the last moment, I was hoping that I would not need it because we started setting it up on the 21st of February. And it was just basically a group chat on Telegram with three people in it, right? And then on the 24th at night, I left a message to the guy saying that the full-scale invasion began, and they started pulling their friends into the group chat. And they later became more regular contributors of Ukraine DAO. And so the day, I obviously, DAOs and Web3 were not exactly on my mind, and I was in a state of shock, speaking to parents, speaking to friends, and then I went to the protest at 10 Downing Street. And by the time I came back in the evening, I opened my laptop, and in our Discord, Discord is where kind of online communities live. There was 2,000 people all of a sudden, you know, and it was like a buzzing place online. A lot of people were like exchanging different ideas. And that's how it kind of kicked off. So it was completely kind of, it looked like it was outside of my control by that time. And so it was not predictable at all.
You've been doing this, obviously, since the start of the full-scale invasion. What are some of the challenges you found along the way? As you said, from everything you've said, you're kind of on the forefront of this cutting-edge technology that even as you can hear from my questions, we still have to sort of really spell it out. You know, what is a DAO? Can we explain crypto? Can we just get those fundamentals? But what are some of the challenges you found with your work over the past few months?
In the beginning, I can tell you, it was hard to communicate to some contributors in the beginning why it's important to support the army, right? The military, especially, I think maybe in the US, they have a very different perception and very different connotation. And not everybody understood why Ukrainians are so passionate about supporting their armed forces. And in Ukraine, right now, armed forces are basically, they're like gods, you know, because all our hope is in them, all our, like, it's an existential hope, you know, and so all of the spare funds, all the non-financial support is going to support our boys and girls who are defending us. But that has to be communicated in the beginning. So that was one thing. Then, God. A lot of stuff. I think just communicating what it means to be Ukrainian and realizing that people just don't sometimes have the full context to the situation, right? So they started following the news on the 24th, but and they mean well. They really want to support Ukraine, but they don't yet know our history, and so a lot of work goes into kind of communicating that to them and helping them educate themselves about the prehistory, what was happening before, what was happening in 2015 when we had the Revolution of Dignity, and kind of explaining that the history of our unfortunate relationship with Russia goes back centuries. So that's a huge challenge to this day.
Moving away from Ukraine, Dow, can we talk about your trips back to Ukraine? You've been there several times this year. Can you tell us a little bit about those visits? Where did you go roughly, and what did you see? What would you want our listeners to know?
I went three times this year. First time, the main goal was to see my parents. I did not expect even to see them this year, and so I was really anxious at first because I was imagining Ukraine like just one hellish place that's in flames and so on. Had a very very wrong perception of it. And then I arrived, and it took me 3 days. Took me 3 days to get there. I drove with my friend from London, and you go there, and it's obviously there is a huge front line. I think it's like 1,000 kilometers length. But apart from there, everything is very orderly, everything is very organized, and everyone is just very, very resilient and very united. And that was very inspiring to see. Second time, we organized a hackathon. It's called Kyiv Tech Summit. It's going to be an annual event. We get a lot of support from our partners, but also from the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine, that are doing absolutely amazing job developing new services all the time, but also supporting grassroots efforts like ours one. And so we were visited by Ukraine's Vice Prime Minister and Minister for Digital Transformation, Deputy Minister as well, so Mikhailo Fedorov and Alex Pernikov. And we had, we hosted a hackathon in a bomb shelter. So that was pretty amazing.
That's extraordinary. Could you tell us a little more about that? What were you doing? You know, what happens in a hackathon, and especially what happens in a hackathon in a bomb shelter?
So we wanted to develop solutions that would make a difference, that would make a positive impact for people in Ukraine, and solve some issues related with disinformation campaign waged by Russia, broken communication system, come up also with, to me, the most, the most important thing, or the most something that appealed to me the most was onboarding Ukrainian IT developers. We have a lot of them. We are a huge IT hub, right? But because a lot of companies have unfortunately struggled this year, a lot of developers ended up being, you know, losing their jobs. And so kind of onboarding them, or even showing them that there are different career opportunities and different communities they could join. So to me, that was the most valuable thing in the hackathon. And in terms of bomb shelter, it was a very good bomb shelter. You know, it didn't look like one. It was hosted in Unit City, which is a really, really beautiful like conference center. And if you saw the pictures, you can look them up in our website, kyivtechsummit.com. It doesn't look like a bomb shelter. You wouldn't be able to tell.
You've mentioned the blockchain. You've mentioned disinformation. I want to ask you a little bit about your work with Starling Lab. This is backed by Stanford, on recording Russian war crimes on the blockchain. And again, I guess the sort of the meta question here is, why is it more effective and useful to do this on the blockchain than another way of doing it? And what are you doing? What are you recording? How is it helping?
So unfortunately, we already have multiple precedents from the past of Russia committing genocide of Ukrainians specifically multiple times, and then not being held accountable for it. So our hope this time is that, the way they do it is by destroying or concealing records of what's happened, denying what's happened, and denying the fact of genocides, to be precise, and then, you know, pretending that they've changed into a more friendly society that is not going to behave like this again, and then it happens over and over again. So, Starling Lab, they work to record evidence of war crimes on blockchain and to kind of create a ledger that is going to be immutable and distributed across different networks. Our work with them that's most significant consisted of our team on the ground going to collect evidence in Kharkiv, evidence of Russia shelling a school, and they do target educational and cultural sites specifically on purpose. That's also part of genocide. And then that cryptographically stored evidence was submitted to the International Criminal Court. And that was, as far as I know, the first kind of evidence like that submitted to the court. And yeah, we are now waiting kind of how that is going to be implemented in, you know, in the consideration. But yeah, so that was part of our work with them.
You've mentioned fighting disinformation. Would you go into some more detail? What kind? I mean, I guess before that, something that's very interesting for people not from Ukraine, not in Ukraine, is what kind of disinformation you see and how you see it playing in the West and elsewhere. And then how are you and your colleagues fighting it?
So we have within Ukraine DAO, we've now moved from fundraising. Our priorities have moved to fighting disinformation and propaganda and amplifying voices of Ukrainian people that have not been listened to enough. They haven't been heard enough over the last years. And that is part of... Oh, sorry, that's my Glico sensor. That's part of the problem, and that's part of why we ended up where we are. And I think the most damaging thing that we've seen is mainstream media being infiltrated by Russians and Russian narratives and Russian lies, essentially. The use of even Kremlin-adopted terminology, right? The use of the words that are describing what's happening. For example, the use of the word crisis instead of the war, conflict, proxy war even, that's it ends up being very dangerous because language creates kind of mental maps in our mind that we then use to kind of make sense of what's happening. And if we use crisis instead of a war or invasion, that creates the kind of picture in our mind where it's easy to assume that there is both sides at fault, which is not the case here. So we try to promote media literacy and critical thinking skills, and we engage a lot with community members online. Try to educate them on kind of sometimes on an individual level, but we also publish a lot of materials through our social media and blogs. And just kind of to engage and educate people about why coverage of Ukraine has to be Ukraine-centric.
Just on that, what was it like? You said you've been back three times to Ukraine to visit your parents and to see other places around the country. What was it like coming back to the UK? Did it feel extremely strange to come into a society where, although people are following the news, it's not necessarily the thing that's on the top of their mind? How did you see that? How did you deal with that?
First of all, it's very sad. it was really sad to leave Ukraine, and people often assume that like Ukrainians abroad, they are somehow disconnected from what's happening, and they are like less Ukrainian even. Sometimes there is assumptions like that. It's very difficult to be away from there. And so we try to kind of find other Ukrainians online and connect. And it's a therapeutic thing to be speaking about Ukraine online. So thank you for having me here in the first place. What's it like? It's hard. It looks like a parallel universe, to be honest. It's difficult. That's pretty much all I can tell you.
No, that's fair enough. So you've raised an awfully huge amount of money through your projects. Where do you see you going next? What's the next steps for Ukraine DAO?
So at the moment, we are working on a Christmas project that is going to focus on this Ukrainian-American carol that many people do not know, actually, that it's Ukrainian. It's called Carol of the Bells. I'm pretty sure that most of people in the audience will recognize it. I can put it up, pull it up and play in the background to show you guys, but I'm pretty sure you can look it up. And then we're also helping to launch Iran DAO at the moment. So that's our next big thing, because obviously the Iranian women that are showing right now incredible courage in the face of adversity that is and regime that is also helping Russia kill Ukrainians, right? So Iran sells drones to Russia that then go and kill Ukrainian people. So kind of resisting that regime and hopefully it being overthrown, that would be very, very helpful for Ukraine. And that's it's part of why we are helping right now Iranian women. So yeah, that's Iran DAO is our next big thing.
May I ask, from your trips back to Ukraine, is there a particular scene or moment that really stands out for you that you'd want our listeners to hear about and understand?
Yeah, it was when we went for a walk with my friends who have a baby, baby Luke or Lukian. He was born a few days before the full-scale invasion began. And then the siren goes off. And we obviously have to go to a bomb shelter. And what we saw in the bomb shelter was really moving. And it was really sad in a way, because it was a music class. And the kids that they were singing, it was a very beautiful sound. But it was also kind of about them being super used to it, right? And it was seeing how normal that became to them, being in a bomb shelter and carrying on with the bomb with the class in such conditions. So that was, I think, one of the most profound moments, and definitely the most the most favorite footage that I filmed in Ukraine.
Elena, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you'd want to bring up that you think is important for our listeners to understand?
I think what's something that Ukrainians are trying to communicate to people at the moment is that we are going through huge trauma, and people are very often quick to kind of tone police us and to make sure that our reactions to what's happening are not too emotional, not too intense, and that's sometimes not helpful. So we try to explain and we try to communicate that it's normal to be it's normal to be hateful in response to what's being done to us. We are going through genocide, and hate is normal. It's a normal, healthy reaction in response to what we are going through. So, kind of normalizing that. What else? I guess I would love to hear some questions that people have, because I'm very curious what is it about Ukraine that interests people.
Sure thing. So we've got one question from Nick, who says, what do you feel about the state of Ukrainian journalism? This is something we've spoken about a little bit, I think, over the past, gosh, what is it now, 192, 193 podcasts. But I think Nick is interested in your take. What is the state of play for journalism in Ukraine at the moment?
First of all, I think coverage of Ukraine is very... it's very either Russia-centric or it's West, like West-centric, right? And sometimes Ukraine's agency is just overlooked, and either Moscow narrative is dominating the place, or the space, sorry, or that of the West, and we feel like Ukrainians think that at the moment Ukrainian voices should be prioritized and amplified, and there is not enough of that. So I think that's the biggest problem at the moment. I guess my closing comment would be that whenever there is a discussion that covering Ukraine, it's super important to have a Ukrainian voice there.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast by The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis, and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 30 days completely free at telegraph.co.uk/audio. You can also listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, do leave a review, as it helps others find the show. To our listeners on YouTube, for reasons beyond our control, there's sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload, so if you do want to hear an episode as soon as possible, it's available on your podcast apps. Please search for Ukraine the Latest on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred app. Check out the Ukraine page on the Telegraph website. As ever, you can get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing podcasts@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. We are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest is produced by Louisa Wells and Giles Gear. And today on Twitter, Emily Hill.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.